Oh, okay, thank you.
Cecilia and Camilla, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi.
That was you heard that for the first time. You just heard yourselves back after performing earlier today. What are your thoughts? What were your first impressions?
That was not us. It was something else.
I also heard some phantasmagoric voices coming in.
Yeah. I think that is the core of the sonic aesthetics of look at that of the space that Joel was mentioning, that where this sound comes from. This sound comes from an ancient tradition of listening to what wants to come out of its own accord. So it's a way of sounding where you cannot actually determine where the sound comes from. It comes from the land itself. It comes from a dialogue. It comes from a listening that listens to itself. It's very mysterious and incredibly beautiful. I can remember the very first time that this sound came from within, and I was truly startled.
Yesterday, we spent some time in the quarry with Cecilia, and it was through her ancestral practice of slowly allowing oneself to seep in and to get lost in the forms and the figures and the noises that begins to prepare the body to do this sounding. So we become very porous, and as Cecilia was mentioning, it's a deep sound that just kind of moves through your body, so listening to it for the first time is an absolute surprise.
And for people that were in the quarry themselves, you were performing, well, across, I imagine. I wasn't there, so I'm reiterating our story. But you performed with your backs to us. So, in fact, you are in direct dialogue with the landscape at setup, really. That the recognition of the listening that we experience is sort of immediately set in, even in the kind of visual setting that you create.
Yeah, that's right. I mean... even from before coming here, when we heard from Joel and the team, Dani and so forth, about the wound of this place, I mean the tremendous pain that is in Tasmania and in this mine in particular, you could feel that coming here was coming like to this place that's alive with pain. And so this is part of why we're here. And so arriving there, and I just heard that there is all this machinery and all this pollution buried there. And so this is like a rock that has been broken open, and there's water coming down. So the desire of the water, the desire of the earth, the desire of the rocks to be rock, to be water, to be soil, for me is something that is overwhelming. I can feel it. And therefore, it is from that relationship that this sound arises.
You asked Joel how he had come to mm-hmm. Cecilia, mm-hmm. and it was really touching to hear him say that it was through trusting me. Also, upon hearing about Flux and the quarry and Liquid Architecture's approach to it, knew immediately that it was Cecilia the poet, Cecilia the healer, Cecilia the magician, the bruja, who could bring forth that quality of the water to cleanse and heal and make things fluid again. Queenstown has been going through a crisis these past years, and to come here and with the voice sort of lick this wound or just give it a bit of a moisture is the little bit that we from Chile could do. You know, we've experienced a lot of similar crises because we share geologies. I went to the geological walk today, or talk, and heard about the volcanic eruptions and the way that all of the layering of rocks has occurred, and it brought me home to the Andes Mountains. And so I think that invisible thread is a thread that Cecilia has been weaving for an eternity, and so that we could sort of pull it through from the center of the earth and make it emerge at the Flux Quarry was something that will have a lasting effect.
Mm-hmm. Bruja is witch in Spanish. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to me the kind of the witchery that you weave? I mean, you have been doing this practice for decades, and so over time, how has that sort of witchery changed from the first inclinations of this is the kind of work that you want to do to arriving at this limestone quarry?
How does it change? I wish I knew. I witness it. I see to it that it may go on. I devote myself to its own ability to grow, move, transform. And so I am at the service of what is coming. And it is such a never-ending relationship. Like, for example, arriving at the place, it was really beautiful to see how the other artists, everybody was in the same mode of sensing, rehearsing. One was touching this, one was the kids were running around. And so, of course, you see how the water is pouring down, and hearing Rob and hearing Dylan and the poets in the space was really, you know, a welcoming in to go always deeper into this relationship. And that's how I started, as you said, a few, maybe a meter or 2 meters away from the water, where I could see the little moss, the little sparkles, the little drops. I could be like inside the transparency of the water. And so it is from there that this emerges, and so sound emerges very much like water emerges in the myth of the northern highlands of Chile, of the Andes Mountains. The sound of the flute, the sound of the human voice, emerges from the sound of the rocks responding to the water, dashing it. So this is an ancient idea that it is through learning from the water sounds that our speech came forth.
Camilla, would you like to?
Just to refer to the word bruja that I use it because brujas have been outcasts. They've been women who are aware of all of that which is in the dark or has been considered vile, precarious, ugly. And it's from that quality of being able to tend to those things that I use the word, not so much in the fantastical sort of sense of the cooking witch,
sure,
the, you know,
sure.
The, but also, I mean, welcome all witches. You know.
to pick up on that idea of. Well, actually, I might ask first. The excerpt that we heard is the two of you in the space. And I'm not going to ask specifically, but there is a generational difference between the two of you. And so how do you then work as a collaborative duo? How do you arrive in a space and say, this is what we'll do? In terms of the relationship between the two of you, and I suppose then the space, which is a given, is always in question.
Yeah, it's true for me. It's a tremendous joy to meet Camila and to see that Camila hears what my work is about, because part of what she was saying is that because my sound is an indigenous woman thing, it has been despised and ridiculed for decades. So for me to find a young woman that is not only willing to hear, but to invite me here and to go along and do her own following in these steps, which is of course her own thing. So how do I collaborate? I collaborate with her or with other musicians in the same form, by not programming, by not planning, by not setting any kind of structure other than let's hear each other and let's move into it. And so she knows that this is the way I work, so she does it too. And we proceed from there. We proceed from the first sound. So that's the key for me, that when you think of improvisation, a lot of people think that improvisation is planned, and some musicians plan improvisations, that's true. But in our case, we really hardly even talk about it. We just know and trust, and it's like we throw ourselves into the abyss, because true sound to me emerges from that encounter with the abyss.
Camilla?
Yeah.
Surely you have one collective voice.
It's such a blessing to collaborate with Cecilia, and it's really through her freedom that I feel allowed and invited, and I learn from that space of sacralizing the improvisation and suspending the expectation that oneself has about one's voice and what should be heard or what sounds good. It's as both as a woman, as a body, as a performer, it's so healing to put myself in line with this practice that she has been exploring, experimenting, and exposing to the world.
So you said before that this landscape, while maybe not immediately familiar to you, is resonant with yours back home, similar geologies. But how is it to put a woman's body in this space, which is predominantly male? I mean, has been kind of driven by male intention, by male physicality, by male approach.
Yeah, it's there's a word that people are using a lot lately, which is decolonizing. And this is, from my perspective, the earth itself is a profoundly feminine energy, so is the water. So all this layer of the conquerors, the invaders, the murderers, the people who have destroyed the ancient cultures, not only here but around the world, to me is like a superficial layer, and it is up to us, the women, to return the power where the power really is, which is in the creativity of the life force. And if you read science, contemporary science, even the word life force has been deleted. You see, science wants to pretend that life can be created in the love. So there is this violence against what is unnamed, what is not controlled, and we represent that. We represent as woman. Any woman has this extraordinary creative energy within. And so to be there is a huge pleasure. It's like a deviation from the norm. It's like breaking the rule. And that in itself is a delight.
La fuerza.
That emergence of that life force that Cecilia is talking about, or to, is this vibratory sensorium, maybe blood-like, menstrual. It's something that's cyclical and that's much larger than one female body. And so to draw it out through the water, as Cecilia was describing, it's this listening to the gurgling, the droplets, and all of that water that is within the body, that is just allowing it to come into a space that's been sort of dominated by maybe a more male paradigm, but it's through a being enchanted with the ways in which the female exists within the male and the male within the female that is what I think allows us to sing. It's not about opposing forces, but about conjoining forces.
One final question, then I want to bring on our next artist, which actually Cecilia, you share a time frame with, which we'll get to. But I wanted to ask, the word poet implies language, which isn't to say that the excerpt we heard doesn't have a language, but do words ever slip into your performances? Is there ever that moment where the more conformist word of poet arrives?
Oh yes, certainly. Words and sounds and breath are really sort of variations of each other. And so words are always in my performance, and even though they may not be heard as words, for example, the first word that I was singing was agüita. And agüita is a sort of a Spanish word, agua, transformed by the Chilean indigenous way of speaking Spanish into little water. So you speak to the water in a language where you say agüita, agüita, and the water hears it. And of course I was saying many other phrases about the wound of the water and so forth, but the phrases and the words are transformed.
Beautiful. Well, thank you both for joining me. Can I invite our next guest up, who's not sitting very far behind? Cecilia, if you just stay for a moment. I'd like to introduce Doug Kahn. Now, Doug, I do have an excerpt of your performance, but I just think it's better if I put you on the microphone. I feel like that's a much more immediate way of...
I have to take my hearing aids
sure.
off.
Sure, yeah, yeah, yeah. Is that better? Can
yeah.
you hear that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Doug, I was just saying that I have a little bit of your performance, but I feel like it's much better if we just, you know, talk to you directly. That that feels more, much more immediate kind of response. Now, I just wanted to draw this fact that that the both of you worked in New York in the early 70s. Is that correct?
No.
Oh, no.
No, I visited New York twice.
Ah.
In the, when would that have been? The early 80s. And once, when I think our connection, Cecilia and my connection, is with a independent publisher called Tanam Press, T-A-N-A-M. And it was the first book that I wrote. It was on the anti-Nazi photomontage artist John Hartfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, was that your first book?
In New York.
In New York, yeah, yeah. So we had the same publisher, and I think pretty sure we were at a party for a book launch for Fire Over Water, which was a collection in which we both had essays, or you had poetry and I had an essay. And so it was either that or... political art documentation and distribution. I was in Seattle, Washington, and I had organized an art and politics conference with Lucy Lepard and Judy Baca and some other people. And it was after that I went to New York and stayed with Lucy for a week in. At her place, and went with to all the events that New York had to offer, and I think and some of it was it was a grassroots national, but it was based in New York, but a national organization called PAD, Political Art Documentation and Distribution, and so I think, yeah, that we met at either Tanam Press or PAD, so. They intersected quite a bit.
But forces outside of yourselves have kind of found ways to bring you together in some way, be it a publisher, be it a party, be it a conference, that in fact there is a direct overlap in your fields of inquiry and the way that you, the ideas that you're interested in.
Oh, there is? how would you represent it?
Well, I would say energies. That's what I would say. That's certainly what I picked up in chatting with Joel and certainly the conversation we just had. And Doug, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the lecture you gave, a performance lecture, I would say, but maybe just a lecture earlier today, which to me is deeply steeped in energies.
Well, that's my topic now. I'm a historian and a historical theorist, I get. I do theories about things about sound and energy, but I do history to try to prove them. I'm insecure about what I'm saying, so I have to refer to other things I can't just make assertions. I have to demonstrate somehow. So I'm a historian. In the 1990s, or starting in the 1990s, I started doing work on the history of sound in the arts, and then I did a collection called Wireless Imagination. Sound, Radio, and the Avant-Garde, and then in 1999 I did a book called Noise, Water, Meat, A History of Sound in the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that
that's better. It's just a loose connection. Anyway.
Oh, there we go. after that I started investigating a topic that took me 12 years to write, which was instead of sound, trying to understand the sort of the trade since the 19th century between electromagnetism and acoustics. you know, they sound like physical phenomena, but they're socially, culturally, aesthetically, and ecologically, as it turns out, especially with energy. There's an elaboration across all spheres of life. Mm-hmm. So that, but in the book, Earth Sound, Earth Signal, that I published in 2013, it was mostly naturally occurring radio. The whole book was based upon what I found out in that Alexander Graham Bell's assistant, Thomas Watson, at nighttime, he would go listen on the first telephone, and the telephone test line over the half mile over the rooftops of Boston turned into an antenna, but nobody knew what an antenna was. And he was listening to these sounds, and they sounded like little bird chirps, and some of them like whistles or flocks of birds in the morning. And it turned out to be natural radio. It was radio that was produced in the ionosphere by the aurora borealis and things like that. So this was 20 years before Marconi. Mm-hmm. So based upon that, it just by putting nature into being the first broadcaster and the first person and a sidekick, not a genius inventor, but a sidekick, being the first person on Earth to hear radio, it just reconfigured a lot of history. So the book I wrote was still had to do with energies in the radio, in the environment, like hello radio, in the environment, and I only got down to brain waves. I got down to seismic vibrations at the Earth scale. All these things were happening at the Earth scale, but I didn't. The only energy I got in was into the in the body was was brain waves, because you go, there's a whole different system of energy in the body from. They're connected, but there's a whole. So but after that book, now I've thrown the doors open on energy, and it's especially there's an imperative with an investigation of energy now for ecological thing. So but what I'm trying to show now that is that there's the fossil fuel and its alternative notion of energy, like energy politics, so-called, but mm-hmm. it actually relates at a very deep level to energy more generally, whether it's vibratory or oscillating or there's, you name it. it's a big field of energy, and it's there's a particular political, if political means survival of the species, there's a political imperative to understand the configurations and the interrelationships of all the larger field of energy. So that's what my talk was based upon.
Just yeah. Right.
Yeah, to give us a sense of that energy and that kind of holisticness, but to me it seems much larger than holisticness. Mm-hmm. Can you, in the example of the limestone quarry, which is how you began this afternoon's conversation, what is it about the limestone quarry and its deep time, or give us the example that you kind of open the speech with that allows it to concretize in some way?
Well, I'd open the speech with something that Henry David Thoreau had talked about in terms of the deep cut. Now, it was a way to see nature at a moment of its destruction. So the deep cut was the cut out of a hillside that they did for railroads. And within that, he saw the erosion and the patterning and the recuperation. He saw nature at work within this big wound. Mm. So that's how I began. But the limestone in particular, well, first of all, it's an amazing space. It is a space of destruction and extraction, but it is also what is left. It's starting to be recuperated now, the water coming down, the plants, the trees growing on the side, the roots will break it up, and the nature will recuperate it eventually. But the limestone itself is not a rock. It's actually a deposition of a life form. And limestone, I said I was presenting a lecture, and this big face of limestone was like a chalkboard. And I used that on purpose because the chalky cliffs of Dover are actually from a plankton, a deposition of plankton, called E-Hux for short. And it's the E-Hux bloom in the oceans are, there's one was so big it was the size of England. It could be seen from outer space. And they have to do with the rock has to do with the sun because the plankton lives in the first few meters at the top of the ocean where the sun penetrates. So it's a life form that then dies off trillions and trillions and settles down, and that's what forms limestone. You put certain limestones under pressure long enough, you get marble. So I was making an argument that what we see is inert rock actually is not just a sort of a trace of life, but actually a moment of a cycling of the sun. Mm-hmm. So you have sort of deep time in a temporal frame of the sun. So you have old sun in things like limestone, but you also have old sun in fossil fuels. And so my talk was about how you can reinterpret ideas of the Anthropocene in terms not of the dead past, but of a cycling of the sun that is still present and will provide our future. So it's a notion of the sort of an ecological notion that's not from geology, it's from heliology. Mm-hmm. So it's from a relationship to the sun, and the sun provides all but 1 in 4,000 parts of our energy. So we talk about the Earth, but in fact the Earth is a pico or a nano scale, you know, in terms of the energy it receives from the sun, but it's the energy that is there is all but 1 in 4,000 parts is how we live. So there's a way to reconfigure ecological notions to talk about the relationship of the sun. But then again, it's like a how do we take light, sound, all these heat, all these phenomena and patterns of energy and start thinking of them as a whole with the purpose of reaching some type of dynamic homeostasis where we don't die as a species.
Yeah. Do you want to, Cecilia, do you want to hop in?
It's absolutely wonderful to hear you, Doug, think in those terms. And I kept thinking while you spoke of heliology and the cycling of this energy from the sun as it relates to the ocean and the plankton and all that. And it's a completely different worldview that you are manifesting in just thinking and sensing and and speaking that way. And so I was thinking, my God, when you think of the ancient peoples of this earth, the ancient Aboriginal Australians, the ancient Incas, where it's the sun, it's all about the sun, it's all about the light. And of course, these peoples have been destroyed and they have been regarded as archaic, primitive, idiotic, silly, stupid, all of that. And now you're turning the table. What's the expression? Turn the table?
Yeah.
Turn the table so that this is the actual thinking that would let us survive. You know, if we follow the path that you're proposing, the cyclical notion is also our thought. You see, the cyclical perception is that work. So it's a cycle of perception that is turning, and we are, you know, part of that music. It's the music of a perception that is at work and relates to the sun, to the light, to the soil. So I'm totally fascinated by your talk.
It's science. Science is catching up. We think that we have to have like a almost like a sycophantic relationship to science, but in fact, in the field of bioenergetics, mm-hmm. it was not until the early 1990s and not until the early 2000s that there was a third retinal cell discovered in the eye. So you have rods and cones, and then you have an intrinsically photosensitive ganglion retinal cell, and that's I had to rename it because the obviously scientists are not very good with words. Yeah. So you know, it's not something you know that falls off your tongue. You know, but it's so I named it solar retinal. And what it is, it actually perceives a thin band of blue light, but it's not an imaging thing. What it is circadian. So it relates to, it's the way that our body relates to the day and night, to the it relates to the sun. So this is not that many years ago, and in fact, but it means that it secretes a melanopsin instead of transducin or rhodopsin, the secreted by rods or cones. It secretes melanopsin, like the color of the melanin or
the skin. Yeah, skin
or
pigments.
Melatonin, yeah. If you're trying to get rid of jet lag or whatever. But so this is very recent, and there's this one scientist who says that bioenergetics, the mechanisms that are there have sort of been swamped over too much by DNA, by the discourse of sort of this code, mm-hmm. this language, as opposed to, you know, of inscription rather than transmission of a you know, it's been. The code has swept over the sort of an energetic view, but it's like very very basic, because if you think of it, the circadian is the position in the solar system that makes us secrete hormones in the body at a very very minute thing. Yeah. So we're synced up. But it's taken till the 1990s, early 2000s, for science to understand, oh, that yes, in fact, we're part of the solar system. You know, individual biologies are part of the solar system. But what they found out since is that the circadian mechanism is actually ensconced in the liver, in all of these different parts of the body. That there's this what's called a sluggish temporality, a sluggish sinking. So it's a rhythm, nevertheless. But it's but we are with the sun, whether we like it or not.
That
This is so... you want to move on?
Well, it's actually time for us to wrap. But okay. But Cecilia, would you give us a final thought, and we'll
wanted to connect what Doug said with what Joelle said in the beginning, and which is that this ancient idea that sounds are connected to the cyclicality of life and to these circadian rhythms. All ancient traditional cultures have known that because there are certain sounds that are for specific hours of the day, for specific seasons of the year, so they're all oriented to the light and to the dark, and so we're coming around.
Yeah, in Indian music, you know, the morning, afternoon, evening ragas, but it's also to the seasons. It's in long cultural traditions, this is expressed in many ways. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to take this conversation offline. It's been absolutely riveting, and I'm sorry we didn't bring you on both sooner. But thank you so much, Camilla, Cecilia, Doug, and Joel, for joining me for just a very small snapshot of the really deep thinking, deep time, deep approaches that were performed today in the Flux and will continue on tonight and tomorrow. I just wanted to leave us with Brendan Walls's performance, which was an absolutely gorgeous, quite a long installation of sounds all around the space. And just thanks again. And you're listening to 7UN, and absolutely check out some of these artists. You'll see them about town. They're just getting started.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, this is Matt Warren. Returning for your hour, for an hour, with a show that we're calling On the Town. You're listening to the tail end of Brendan Walls' piece that he created today, actually, at Flux in the Quarry here at Queenstown for the Unconformity Festival. What we're doing for the rest of the hour, taking us up to 9 o'clock, is listening to some audio portraits of local folks, a bit of music. We're going to cross to Flux Live as well with our roving reporters, and I've also got a very special guest in the studio, Guy, who's helped us tremendously by creating the antenna that we're broadcasting the AM part of this radio station from. So we'll chat to him later. First of all, though, we'll go to an audio portrait about Burn Bradshaw. Here he is, local guy Burn Bradshaw.
One, if you open it, close it. Two, if you turn it on, turn it off. Three, if you unlock it, lock it.
Well, this is really an old-fashioned sawmill. These are some of the bits and pieces that we cut. They're boat slabs, those. They'll go to the boat builders, who will mark their planks out. Thing about boats is everything's crooked in a boat. There's nothing straight. A sawmill gets hold of a log and cuts the board straight. The boat builder gets the board and he cuts a crooked board out of it. So it's a terrific waste of wood. That's King William Pine. That's an old...
Oh, well, my name's Burn Bradshaw. Yeah, we run a sawmill. And main enterprise is in Ewan Pine, preparing the wood, sawing it, drying it, and then
it's not selling strong. It's fairly strong, but it's durable by virtue of it has an oil content which really preserves it, yeah, and it gives it an aroma as well. You know, that
my dad had a sawmill at the Princess River and a little village. When the Lower Gordon was knocked back, the hydro came into this area of the country and started building dams, built Lake Burberry, which flooded our sawmill and village.
You know, they didn't do
and as a last resort of somewhere to go, either that or pack up and change your way of life, we decided to come here.
Fashion. There's timbers like myrtle and blackwood, and they used one time to be called fashion timbers because people's tastes came and went, just like your clothing and that. They were in vogue for a time, and then people lose interest in them. They go into something else. Maybe 40 years' time, it'll be the surge again of the
golden rule of this establishment. Four, if you break it, report it. Five, if you can't fix it, call someone who can. Six, if you borrow it, return it.
More often than not, we find people don't have the freedom to buy what they used to be able to buy.
Mm.
But there is a market out there. People still have a strong interest in wood, solid wood.
Tree timbers like you and me, you know, we're all the same, but we're all different, you know. Some are soft and pliable, others are hard as nails and all that, you know, in nature and physically too, yeah. That's the old-fashioned hand sharpener there, what they call a gulliging machine. You know, the offcuts of the bits of pieces, and if
if they don't go to anything else, they go into firewood for sticks. These pieces here, they cut bowl blanks out of these. We used to
deep bowls.
Handle, you know, blackwood and myrtle and celery top pine and sassafras and all those woods. But of course, they're just about out of reach to us in our part of the world now. We're surrounded by World Heritage and National Parks. Consequence of that is that we're very limited in what we have to offer these days.
They're quite a good market for big bowls and things like that, you know, in certain places. Mm.
10, if it doesn't concern you, leave the bloody thing alone.
Sort of offcuts in a way, but...
Nature's very resourceful, and when you go into the forest and select the trees, selectively cut the trees down, you'll find the young ones that grow straight away. They're up and away. You know, the next generation's there coming. But when it's all just sealed off and just dormant, nothing much happens. So, it's rather simple, really, but politics get in the way today. Forest is not much different to people, really. The seeds go out and they germinate and they flourish and fade away, like the flowers in the garden. And the forest is the same.
These pieces. Someone somewhere will have a treasure of that. Yeah, you know, and pieces like that. And, if I didn't like trees, I wouldn't be here, would I?
It's a waste of piece of wood the way it is there.
But to someone, it represents something of interest.
Yeah.